If you'd like to listen to the Daily Blast, plus all of our other DSR content without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, and enhanced show notes for select shows. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code GREG to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code GREG. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. This week, something really big is set to happen. Mike Johnson appears ready to decide whether he'll move forward with a vote on funding military aid to Ukraine. If he does, Marjorie Taylor Greene has threatened to call a vote to oust him as Speaker, so this week may also decide whether she is able to take him down, again throwing the House into chaos. You'd think Johnson would fear such an outcome, yet something funny has happened. It's become clear that a lot of House Republicans want to vote on Ukraine aid. Is there any chance it might actually pass? How will Donald Trump react? How big is the pro-Putin caucus in the House GOP anyway? To unravel all this, we're speaking today to Julia Iafi, a journalist for the Puck News site who covers these matters in a very illuminating way. Welcome, Julia.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Okay, so first, can you tell us about your personal connection to all this?
Well, I'm originally from Russia. I have been studying and reporting on the place for over 20 years. And the fact that the country, I mean, we left as refugees, hasn't been home for a long time, but the fact that the country that I'm from has attacked another country that pretty much most of my family is from originally is pretty horrific and emotionally brutal.
Okay, so what we now know is that Johnson is mulling several possible ways to hold a vote on Ukraine aid. One would give Biden the authority to take over frozen Russian assets and use those. Another is to do aid in the form of a loan in some way. Still another is to package aid with something overturning President Biden's ban on liquid natural gas imports. What's your sense of the most realistic endgame here in terms of what Johnson might do?
Well, it seems like he's going to try to put all three in this bill if he can get that done. He's had quite a while to mull this over. But it's important to understand that all three of these things are cosmetic in nature. Most Russian assets, frozen Russian assets, are not in the U.S. They're in Europe and in other jurisdictions. It would really only give the U.S. $5 billion to play with. Compare that to the $60 billion for Ukraine in this supplemental. Making it a loan, this would also be window dressing. First of all, because it would be a zero interest, waivable loan, kind of like the PPP loans we remember from four years ago. And also, it would cover a very small part of this aid package. Most of the Ukraine aid in the supplemental is in the form of military aid, and that money pretty much completely stays in the U.S. It is for U.S. weapons manufacturers creating U.S. jobs, mostly, by the way, in red states, deep red states like Alabama. And it is to replace all the old stuff that we are dumping in Ukraine, that Ukraine is using. Basically, we're paying ourselves to modernize our stockpiles. And the rest that would be actually made into a loan is a small fraction of this aid package, which is for basically budgetary support for the Ukrainian government. So the Ukrainian government can pay soldiers, can pay its officials, and not collapse under the economic pressure of this war. Remember, Ukraine has lost anywhere from 30% to 50% of its GDP because of this war, depending on how you count it. Whereas Russia's GDP is growing in part because of all the military spending they're doing. And the LNG piece is also cosmetic because even despite the Biden administration's moratorium, LNG production and exports in the U.S. are set to double in the next 4 years. This would just be a way to kind of strike a blow at the Biden administration, take away one of his environmental climate agenda wins. And it would also crucially bring an LNG terminal to Mike Johnson's district, which is part of the reason.
Is it reasonable for us to expect that, as you say, these cosmetic measures are really about giving Republicans a way to support the thing, and the rest of the package will actually be something reasonably decent? Is that too optimistic?
No, I think that's basically what pro-Ukraine Republicans are trying to do, just to give, you know, a spoonful of sugar for this supplemental to go down.
Okay, so what would that mean for Ukraine? Is there an endgame you can see here where there's actually something that really helps?
Well, I think all of this would really help. Ukraine has been running on fumes, less than fumes, I would say, since American aid ran out 4 months ago at the end of 2023. Ukrainians are rationing ammunition. They're unable to fight back as hard against Russian attacks. Russia has seized the momentum and the initiative across the entire front line. Russia is pummeling Ukrainian cities and infrastructure. A lot of Kharkiv, which is Ukraine's second biggest city, remains without power. They've had to turn off the heat early this winter season to kind of ration electricity. And in part, this is because Ukraine is running out of air defense missiles and air defense ammunition, because that's what they're waiting on from us. My worry is that even if the supplemental passes, and I still think that's a big if, because the more Mike Johnson is dragging his feet, the more it kind of gives the hard right time to mobilize against him. And he has not shown himself to be a particular profile in courage. But even if it does pass, I think that's probably it for 2024 in terms of American aid getting through Congress for Ukraine. I can't imagine Republicans handing the Biden administration another win in an election year, especially as Donald Trump steps up his attacks, which is also insane. You know, we're supposed to have one president at a time, but we have this other guy in the wings, former president, effectively trying to set, and sometimes setting it successfully, foreign policy for the U.S. So I worry that this is basically our last shot to give Ukraine an infusion of weapons. That might not be so bad, because by 2025, a lot of the stuff Ukraine ordered and paid for in the spring of 2022 will finally come online. These weapons contracts take a long time to fulfill, but they really need our help to help get them there.
If there's any cause for optimism at all, it seems that it lies in the fact that a number of very powerful House Republicans seem to want this aid to happen. I think that's a bit surprising to many liberals, who kind of were defaulted to the position that there's no way Johnson would do this. You hear some voices on social media calling him a Russian asset and so forth. And yet you've got Michael McCaul, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, demanding this. And he even flatly declared that Russian propaganda has infected a good chunk of his party's base. This is something you talked with him about yourself. How remarkable is it that senior Republicans are directly indicting a swath of their own party as almost a fifth column of sorts?
Well, I think they're getting really fed up. Mike McCaul has been very strong and strident on Ukraine from the very beginning, as have other Republicans, in part because they're old school Reagan Republicans who understand the threat posed not just by China, but by Russia to the U.S. They understand that lying down and letting Russia take Ukraine doesn't really fix anything. It just kicks the can down the road and makes the problem bigger down the road. The way McCaul put it to me is basically, we're trying to prevent Europe from getting to a 1939 situation. We're trying to provide aggressive deterrence in Ukraine so that this doesn't turn into a larger conflict where NATO is drawn in and American boots do have to be on the ground and American blood is spilled. And he's trying to make that argument to his constituents, to his fellow party members, that this is basically a cheap preventative measure and a way of preventing Russia from going further and pulling us in. One thing I will note from my conversation with Chairman McCaul is, you know, he pointed out a generational difference in his party where people like him who grew up during the Cold War idolizing Reagan have one view of Russia, whereas many of his younger colleagues, including the primary challenger he bested back in March, are much younger. They don't remember the Cold War. What they do remember are the forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And their kind of, on one hand, very old school, century old isolationism is also flavored by the foreign policy debacles of the early 21st century, or the American foreign policy debacles of the early 21st century. Another thing I'll mention is there was a report today in the Washington Post by the inimitable, legendary Russia reporter Catherine Belton, author of Putin's People, where she basically described a trove of Kremlin documents that show the Kremlin trying to manipulate American public opinion by directly targeting right-wing Republicans, directly parroting a lot of this stuff about how there shouldn't be another sent to Ukraine until we've secured the southern border, that Zelensky is corrupt. I mean, it's really just exactly the same talking points. And it really, for me, underscored what Chairman McCaul was saying, how, yeah, a lot of these people are parroting Russian propaganda points. Russian propaganda is also parroting right-wing, kind of Trumpy talking points, and on the cycle goes.
Yes. And on that score, I want to ask you something. You did ask McCaul something very interesting, whether standing with Ukraine in defense of democracy means anything to the GOP base anymore. Now, to your point about how it really does appear as if a swath of the Republican Party is in the grip of Russian propaganda, you have some leading GOP politicians in the MAGA mold, like Green and J.D. Vance in the Senate, who are at best indifferent to Russia waging violent conquest against Ukraine, or at worst, tacitly want Russia to succeed, or even somewhat openly at times. Now, I wonder, though, whether this kind of Putin-esque sentiment is sort of a creation of the right-wing media, of Tucker Carlson and Elon Musk's Twitter and all his Elon Musk's friends. How deeply do we think this pro-Putin sentiment runs with the actual GOP base? Is it just sort of a bubble created by a combination of Russian disinformation and the confluence of that with a lot of right-wing media content?
I think it goes back at least a decade, if not further, of the right-wing, especially the evangelical right-wing in the U.S., building bridges to the right-wing in Russia, and vice versa. They've been working kind of hand in glove for a long time on, for example, restricting abortion access in Russia, where abortion has been basically legal with a small window where it wasn't since 1920, so for over 100 years. And vice versa. I think there is just a kind of, in part, a natural ideological affinity between the right wings of our two countries. That is basically Christian imperialistic nationalism, homophobia, transphobia. You also have Putin very ably playing this up, I think, not just at home, but when he speaks about why he's invading Ukraine, why he's fighting in Ukraine. You know, things like, oh, we've discovered gender-neutral bathrooms in Ukraine. That's why we're fighting them. You know, that's in part for domestic consumption, but I think it's also for consumption by the American right wing, so that when Tucker Carlson says things like he did on the eve of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, when he said, why are we against Putin when he's our ideological ally and basically wants the same things as us, why are we fighting him instead of working with him? These roots have been traced back by many reporters, myself included, for at least a decade of the right wings of the two countries working together.
You hit on a really important point there that I think is lost on a lot of reporters and commentators who kind of cover the national political debates here. There's a contingent of MAGA Republicans who want Putin to win because they admire his type of leadership.
Exactly.
They see his leadership as kind of a model for what could be done here to deal with the woke, the liberal, secular, godless forces that are, you know, supposedly doing a long march through our institutions, a phrase that they often use. It's not an accident that J.D. Vance and Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of flirt with Christian nationalism at the same time that they also clearly want a Putin victory.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, Putin is unapologetically, especially in the last 10 years, has become an unapologetically white Christian nationalist leader. He flicks at white replacement theory. He has labeled the quote-unquote global LGBT movement an extremist movement. So now legally in Russia, the LGBT movement, whatever that is on par with ISIS and the Taliban, which, by the way, is being taken off the list of extremists because Russia wants to be able to kind of have diplomatic relations with the government of Afghanistan. It is, you know, fighting wokeness or the new ethics, as the Russians call wokeness, which is a problematic term, but I'm not even going to get into that. Again, the kind of the promotion of big families, of male dominance, of patriotic education in schools, the same kind of rewriting of history that Republicans would love to see in American schools is happening at warp speed in Russian schools. And, you know, Trump, for his part, has been pretty open about his admiration of Putin and of Kim Jong-un, in part because, you know, he says, like what he said about Kim Jong-un a couple of times, where he said, you know, when he speaks, his people sit up and listen, otherwise they'll be shot. And that's the kind of leadership I want. And that's also the kind of leadership that's the kind of regime that Vladimir Putin has. And again, it's this kind of, it's also what we saw in the 1930s in the US, this kind of contingent of Americans who don't see a problem with fascism, with authoritarianism. They just don't see a problem with it. And it's not just about American neutrality or turning inwards and not wasting our blood and treasure on foreign conflicts and just focusing it internally on getting rich. It's also about a comfort, and not just a comfort, but a longing for a strong hand and authoritarianism that is consistently appealing to a part of the American population that is clustered in certain parts of the country.
It really is a shame that a lot of our reporters and commentators describe this as quote unquote isolationism. It just isn't that. It's as you point out. And there's something funny about this too. Well, funny is the wrong word, but I think Trump really admires the strongman dictator part of Putin and Orban and the axis of autocrats, right? And he probably doesn't care quite as much about the woke stuff, the anti-woke stuff, the anti-LGBTQ stuff. Whereas Marjorie Taylor Greene and J.D. Vance and politicians like that really see an opportunity to deliver a brutal blow to secular liberal democracy. So this brings me to Greene and Trump for a sec. So it's unclear what Trump will do if Johnson does hold a vote, right? It's sometimes said that the idea of a loan is his idea. And so if Johnson does it that way, maybe it's easier for some Republicans. They can say, this is Trump's idea. Yay. Do we even know how he'll react? It seems like his own pro-Putin sentiment might kick in, or he'll rage at Biden getting a victory, or both. How do you anticipate Trump reacting if Johnson holds a vote on something?
It seems like there's a mix of things going into Trump's thinking. One is, you know, he doesn't like Ukraine and likes Putin. Also, remember Ukraine, Zelensky, Ukraine aid, that was the stuff of his first impeachment. So some of the bitterness, I think, comes from there. Second of all, it's in part about just hamstringing Biden during an election year. And three, I think it's just about Trump. It's not even about policy. It's not about whether it's a loan or not. It's about, you know, what's good for Trump and whether people are obedient to him, whether his party is obedient to him. Part of this I see as just him standing on the sidelines and flexing. You know, I used to referee soccer, and when I was taking the FIFA classes to get my, you know, get my badge, I remember the instructor telling us a story about how during a kids game, there was a parent on the sidelines who had a whistle too, and he would run up and down the sideline blowing the whistle whenever he thought the referee would make a call. And, you know, the 8-year-olds on the field would of course stop because they heard a whistle, and it would completely disrupt the game. And it was a question about kind of how do you deal with a disruptive parent like that. The ref gave him a red card, ejected him from the field. But I keep thinking about that image when I think about the kind of policy influence that Trump is exerting on the Republican Party, even while he's not in office. He's the parent running up and down the sideline during a game and blowing the whistle when he thinks the ref missed a call, and completely undermining the ref's authority.
Yeah, that seems like about as deep as it goes for him. It's interesting that no Republicans have committed to ousting Johnson. So I wonder if Green might just not end up trying to oust him, or if she does, such an effort might fail. Is it possible that MAGA pro-Putin sentiment isn't actually that deeply felt or widespread in the GOP conference after all?
Well, I think it is deeply felt, but I think for a lot of the members, it's kind of striking a balance between needing Trump's approval with their own base back in their districts so they don't get primaried from the right. And part of it is, you know, if they oust another speaker less than 6 months after they ousted the last one, and they do so in an election year, what chances do they have of retaining a majority in Congress, which is already, you know, razor thin. It's not really a much of a majority to speak of even. So I wonder if it's just people not having much of an appetite. On the other hand, you know, there were people who weren't committed to ousting McCarthy when the motion to vacate was filed against him. And then kind of more people glommed on as it, as the thing kind of grew legs and gathered momentum. So we know that part of the conference is predictably unpredictable. So, and I think that's also what's weighing on Johnson's mind. Like, does he stand a chance? Hakeem Jeffries has talked about repeatedly helping Johnson out if MAGA Republicans were to trigger a vote to oust him. But, you know, does Johnson want to be seen as a Democratic speaker as a result of that vote? So I think there's a lot in the mix.
A lot of things in play, and it's really, as you say, highly unpredictable. Last question. You monitor Ukrainian and Russian media and the political debates over there. So how is our argument over all these issues playing over there? Are Ukrainian media sources optimistic or pessimistic about aid coming through? And is Russian propaganda confidently predicting that Ukraine aid will fail and or cheering on MAGA politicians and Trump to sink it?
Yeah, Russian state media is gloating over this, about the fact that Ukraine is losing support, that Americans are kind of waking up to how bad Ukraine is, and that overall it's contributing to a sense of victory in Russia, that Putin was right all along, that he could just wait out the Americans, that Americans are fair weather friends, even to their quote unquote puppets, like in Kiev, which is how they imagine the Ukrainian government. They think it's just an overall signal of American weakness, unreliability in the world, and yeah, that Putin is going to win, that Russia is going to win in Ukraine, that it's already winning, and that victory is kind of just around the corner. And if the aid fails, then Russia will be able to kind of press Ukraine to the end and finish the job and take Kiev in the next couple of years. Those aims have not changed. You know, the idea that on the right and on the left that you could settle this with Putin and just give him, you know, whatever territory in Ukraine he's already taken, and that the war will stop. That's just not true. He has shown no intention, has spoken of the fact that his aims have not changed. It is to take Kiev, replace the government there, and to swallow up Ukraine, which he thinks is not a real country, but should be part of Russia. That negotiation is not something that would end the war long term.
As you say, he has predicted that he'll be able to wait out the United States. And if that proves true, I think it will also be held up by the kind of forces of rising right-wing authoritarianism around the world as another sign of the decadence of Western liberal democracy. A lot is at stake, and this week is going to determine a whole lot going forward, folks. So we'll all be watching it closely. Julia, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Folks, make sure to check out two new pieces up at TNR.com. Walter Shapiro on how the party of Reagan has become the party of appeasers, and Sarah Leonard explaining how gender increasingly shapes the politics of the global right wing. You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.